You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
Hello, this is Dean Radin. I'm introducing my chat partner today, Lynn McTaggart. Lynn is an award-winning author of 5 books, including the international best-selling Sensations, The Field, and also The Intention Experiment. She is an internationally recognized spokesperson on the science of spirituality and maybe the spirituality of science. She's also the editor of a master class called Living the Field, a comprehensive 4-year work on how the findings of the new science, impacts your everyday life, and holds many conferences and workshops worldwide. So I guess.
Thank you, Dean. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dean. And Dean Radin is one of my heroes, who is in both of my books and has done amazing science about the power of intention and many other areas of extended mind, and an author in his own right with, of course, in the best-selling Entangled Mind. We're talking today about a big question, how we can create a great shift on planet Earth in the years ahead. And we have some interesting thoughts about it. I guess we wanted to start with the whole idea of science and where we can go and what we can do and what we can learn from the kind of science that people like Dean are conducting. Dean, what do you think where should we be first looking at to make a shift in science? What's the new science telling us about what we should be doing?
Well, I think before we get to what the science is telling us, one of the big shifts that I see is necessary is changing the assumptions in the academic world that has prevented this dialogue from taking place at all. And one of the ways of seeing that a taboo has prevented this is by looking at the number of institutions of higher learning around the world, roughly 17,500, and then looking at the number of those institutions where there's at least one faculty member who's known for being interested in what might be called new science or new ideas in science. And the answer there is something like 50, which means that way over 99% of all of the academic institutions around the world don't have a single faculty member who's known for their interest in these topics. That means that there's like a couple of handfuls of us who are trying to push the envelope hard. And that's a problem, because on the popular side, if you ask the average person in the street about their interests, there are many interests that people have which aren't covered in academia at all. And as long as that taboo persists, it means that the dialogue that we're having now is simply not going to take place at a large scale. And you can't change the world very easily, especially in the scientific world, unless you have thousands and thousands of scientists working on problems, not just a handful.
I think we saw that, I know, in the books that I've written, most of the so-called heroes in the field were persecuted for simply being a scientist in the real sense of the term, which was to be a real explorer and to allow themselves to go in places that they hadn't expected and to allow the experimental evidence to drive them, even if it's a place that they didn't want to go to.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that's what really distinguished all of the scientists. But some of them lost their jobs. Most of them were censured in the general literature, or they couldn't get published. They can't get published in the standard scientific journals. So that is outrageous. But I think that what is beginning to happen is certainly in frontier areas. Some of the conventional places like University of Chicago or the University of Vienna are providing information on the very frontier that is upending much of what we believed about our scientific world and our scientific story. And as that happens, it will slowly push the move to a new reality. I mean, certainly this must have happened when quantum physics was first discovered. You know, nobody wanted to accept it. And then slowly but surely it pushed, you know, and discovery pushed that chapter and allowed that chapter to unfold and allowed us all to understand that, you know, science as we know it is just a story. You know, we think of it as some ultimate truth, but it's just a story with chapters. And the new chapter is just about to unfold. But hopefully with the kind of research you're doing and high-profile material that's going on in some of these areas and interest in the public, there might be more pressure on academia to shift along with the frontier.
I hope that you're right, but because you said that, and you're correct, that there's a certain kind of prosecution that pushes people out of the mainstream if their ideas are not acceptable. And because these cases are so well known, that I know many more conventional colleagues who are privately very interested in these topics, but because they're in positions of prominence, they know that they cannot even say a positive word. They're scared, basically, and rightly so, because, you know, if you have responsibilities to others, then you need to protect your job. So we have a little bit of a vicious social cycle, in a sense. And it's true, it may take two or three generations for these changes to occur, but I think the nice thing about the general thrust in science is that we're interested in what the truth is. And so the truth is inescapable. It just takes a while sometimes to show up.
I know, and what might be interesting in this situation is that this could be culturally led, because there is such an emphasis now, more than ever before, on looking toward a new paradigm. People are doing this in great numbers in different kinds of little groups, as Paul Hawken writes about. It's this social revolution that's going on, cultural revolution going on in many, many sort of pods all over the place, but collectively a huge number, because people are worried about the fact that science perhaps has brought us to the brink of extinction. You know, we're all worried about our technical mastery now blowing up the universe. So it could well be that social pressure for the first time pushes science in a new direction.
You may be right, because it may be very much like the fall of the Berlin Wall. So there was something that was a physical impediment for a long, long time, and when the grassroots began to push, it fell very quickly. And so one of the topics I know that you want to talk about actually is relevant to this idea of the Berlin Wall falling, and that's the idea that allopathic medicine has for a long time been extremely strict about its rejection of alternative and complementary medicine, including things like energy medicine, partially because it doesn't fit into the Western worldview and also for economic reasons and so on. But because there's so many people worldwide spending untold billions of dollars on these alternative methods, the National Institutes of Health created first an office and now a division to look at these things. And the budget keeps increasing every year because people are demanding that something be done.
I think that's really true. And I think what's happening now is it's now becoming really evident that conventional medicine for the chronic problems just doesn't work. It's now got to the point where it's the number one killer in the West. It's now surpassed heart disease, cancer, and stroke as the number one killer. I think the statistics are now that even with correctly prescribed drugs, something like the Twin Towers, the number of casualties in the Twin Towers dies every other week in America on correctly prescribed drugs alone.
So what's the number one killer?
Is modern medicine.
Oh, you mean
it's killing more people, correctly prescribed drugs, than cancer or heart disease or stroke. It's now moved to number one slot. It was number three, I think, and now it's moved to number one.
Wow.
So this is not emergency medicine, which is brilliant. You know, I mean, if I get run over by a bus tomorrow, I want the best of high-tech medicine to put me back together again. But this is, you know, drugs, side effects of drugs, that are and side effects of correctly prescribed operations or drugs that just don't work.
Huh.
And it's the statistics are now pretty shocking and now evident that perhaps that paradigm we've been using, which is in modern medicine, body is machine, and body only driven by chemistry, has to be looked at and examined in light of new findings that are of people like you discovering that we are a lot more than that. We're a lot more than a collection of chemicals, and that's evident in the fact that the medicine based on that just isn't working.
Hmm. Yeah. I guess what we're talking about then is that the Western scientific model has been extremely successful in many ways in thinking of the world as a mechanistic, reductionistic machine. It works. I mean, lots of things simply do work. But that same idea has been applied to virtually everything in science, including the human body, and it doesn't work quite so well in some areas. And of course, the real irony is that by looking at the structure we call the brain, the conclusion was that there's nothing going on inside, that what we think of as our mind or as consciousness is simply a side effect. It's like a refrigerator throwing out heat. It's meaningless. And yet, further down, as we get into the quantum world, then suddenly you can no longer escape the notion of consciousness as being an important element. And somehow this has not been reconnected yet in the scientific worldview.
No, and yet it's, you know, we're just starting to learn so many things about brilliance in energy medicine. Applying some of these new concepts to medicine are incredible. I mean, I was recently at a conference and was just blown away by some evidence about emotional freedom techniques, which are a new kind of energy medicine used for psychological problems. And they were using them because they really couldn't afford a lot of other kind of medicine in former Yugoslavia with the whole conflict there. After the Serbs had systematically killed half of a family, many, many halves of families, in order to traumatize the victims. And here were people filled, you know, people who were severely traumatized, post-traumatic stress syndrome. And they brought in emotional freedom techniques and used it on this population and had 100% response. Now, that is unheard of in medical studies, and it's being written up in the Journal of Traumatology. And I thought to myself, I've never seen statistics like that with conventional medicine. And those kinds of new techniques that seem really weird and wacky must be explored on a scientific basis if they have that much promise. And we must, I guess, the big shift has to be just opening our minds and perhaps, again, a bottom-up thing of promoting this kind of energy medicine and this kind of plurality in medicine to be allowed.
Can you describe what that technique is and why it's different?
It's very wacky. It is about tapping on acupuncture points and taking a thought. It's thought-led. It's intention-led. And it's taking a thought and holding the thought and then tapping on certain acupuncture points and working on negative thought and working it into positive thought. And so it would seem to be, you know, very wild and wacky with no basis in any kind of fact. And yet it's basically saying that a thought is held in the body and is, you know, and it, you can you change the thought, you change the body system.
Huh. So this is, I think, also called thought field therapy?
It's very similar to thought field therapy, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And those are all a collection of this energy psychology, which I think is very interesting. I only bring up the emotional freedom one because I believe that's the one, or it could have been the thought field one that has the evidence
mm-hmm.
that's demonstrated to work. And I think that all of these have to be explored in some kind of scientific and rigorous way because they have enormous implications,
mm-hmm.
but as does acupuncture and homeopathy, you know,
right.
The older energy systems.
Right, and then again, we're pushing against entrenched interests that don't want these things to be studied. Just the other day, I had a correspondence with someone who was arguing that it was okay to use ridicule against ideas, and by the way, okay for a rational scientist to use ridicule to suppress crackpot ideas. And of course, that was the claim. And my claim was, well, using ridicule is not a rational response at all. So that should never be used, ever, on anything that's considered to be crackpot, because today's crackpot is tomorrow's Nobel laureate. You know that.
Absolutely. And so science has always been. You don't have that kind of open-minded exploration, you don't have science.
Right.
But I think that is that's the thing that's happening now, is maybe this, you know, this the skeptics are shouting louder because I think they feel that, you know, they're losing the battle. They're losing the hearts and minds of the West now. People are understanding that these old systems, they're beginning to understand. Look at, in terms of alternative medicine, more people, just in the UK and in the US, more people visited an alternative practitioner in the last few years than have visited a conventional doctor. There were more visits paid to alternative practitioners. So in the UK, where we have a free national health service, that's astonishing. So it's people are voting with their feet, and I think that shift in the allowance, the open-mindedness, is occurring. The problem is, as you say, there is in terms of the what's going on in the establishments, you've got one of the most powerful lobbies in the world in the pharmaceutical industry.
Okay.
And so that's something that we have to, I guess the shift has to occur once again bottom up.
Although, you know, the interesting thing is that I bet if there were surveys taken anonymously within the pharmaceutical industry and allopathic medicine, that the majority of people in those fields are also using alternative methods. And so, because they're
yes,
people too, you know, then they recognize
yes,
the limitations of their own world. So at some point, I think this is an answer to how do we create the great shift? Well, necessity creates a shift. And the necessity in the case of medicine is, as you said, that the number one killer of people now is medicine, or at least misapplied medicine. So
yes, exactly. And so that will push the shift forward as we learn.
Right.
And I guess what will happen is, and I hope what will happen is because this new science is demonstrating that we are anything but this mechanistic entity, that our new medicines will then begin to mirror this and be open to trying things that are non-local, you know, like healing, and that go beyond the kind of material, like homeopathy, and that there will be, you know, as there are customers and patients wanting this, so there will be people willing to try and test it to demonstrate this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there will be the future of medicine will look so different than what we currently have. I think you mentioned that emergency medicine, surgeries, will probably stay the same or continue
yes,
evolving because they're just so effective. But there are many other aspects of medicine that are currently considered alternative, which will become mainstream. It's almost hard to imagine what a future hospital may look like.
And it's just being open to all sorts of things, whether it is bringing the spiritual into. I was very interested to talk with Mitch Krukoff, who was talking about an Indian hospital and how the spiritual is all part of a very high-tech cath heart lab, and how that embracing of the spiritual with the allopathic worked better. And so there will be everything from that to, I hope, looking and trying the weirdest and the wackiest of equipment that just seems very strange now, but perhaps based on principles of this unfolding new science, will be delivering intention in medicine.
You know, I think that the idea of trying many things for some scientists is frightening. It's frightening to imagine that not only many of the things that you were taught may not be completely true. That's one source of fright. But the other one is that it seems to open a Pandora's box, and then you find yourself surrounded by lots of things, and you don't know what you can believe anymore, what you can rest upon. So this is maybe a psychological or a sociological issue that we may need to face. And I know that some of my colleagues who are a little bit more conventional, they just don't want to have to deal with things that they consider to be a little bit too far out in the fringe, even though the things out in the fringe are perfectly true. They just don't want to deal with it.
I think that would be scary for everybody. And, in fact, it is scary in a sense because, you know, we are all traveling without a compass now. We've all recognized that, you know, the science we grew up with, you know, I grew up at a time where the phrase was better living through chemistry, you know, and we were all, that was a little phrase in America. And, you know, we were all looking to, I always thought of that as a catchphrase of technological mastery. And, you know, here I was in the greatest country in the world, and we could fly to the moon, and we could, you know, we could harness the world. And that whole worldview is really slipping away now in so many regards. And we're now realizing that that mindset, as I said, has brought us to the brink. So it is kind of scary. We don't have a compass for this. All we do know, though, is one of the big things that's important about creating a great shift is the idea that we have to look at a lot of our societal structures we've created, whether it's education, business, the neighborhoods, our countries, our planet, because they are all based on an old scientific model. You know, science tells us how to live, in a sense. It tells us how we're made and how the world's made. And we're now discovering with the new science that the world we thought, that we relied on, doesn't really exist in that way. That it's not this well-behaved universe with lots of things operating completely according to fixed laws, that the things are a lot weirder than we thought, and consequently, perhaps we have to look at our structures, all based on this whole idea of us being separate entities and therefore competitive with each other, and create a new structure in every regard. And that's scary.
Yeah, I think it's maybe a little. What I often hear is comments like, "Well, if that's true," pointing to anything on the fringe. If that's true, then we have to throw away all our textbooks and learn astrology. And that's a misplaced fear, because I think it's quite true that what science has learned to date has gone through a very severe vetting process. And so we can be pretty confident about many of the things that we've learned in science. The problem is that that's not the whole picture. It's a little slice of the picture. And so when people say we're going to have to throw away the textbooks, I'll say, well, no, we'll just have to come out with a new revision. And the revision will make this a slightly more comprehensive picture, or maybe radically more comprehensive, but it's not going to throw away what we already know.
No, and that kind of math, as you say, is just not the whole story. Mm-hmm. And one has to always think of science as an unfolding and it occurring chapter by chapter.
Right.
So you don't lose what it is. You refine what you had, and that you then say, okay, so we now know this, and this really maybe colors what we had before, but it doesn't completely discard it. Sometimes it does. I mean, we now know that, you know, that the world isn't flat. You know, we know a few things like that we used to think, but we refine in most cases, but I think the revolution that's gone on, you know, since quantum physics certainly is speeding up that process of revision, and maybe making us think that our worldview, which has created this technological mastery, but also caused a whole bunch of problems, is really the thing that has to shift.
Mm-hmm. I recently wrote a short story on an imagined world in the future, perhaps 100 years from now, where the worldview has significantly revolved, and so that both material and mental are on equal grounds. And at that stage, the story is from the point of view of people living in that stage, they will, of course, find new problems that are as horrendous in their day as ours are in our day, that come up because we can't always see what the future brings very well. There's always unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There will be a bizarre observer effect type of thing that will occur in the future that will, you know, continue on the human educational condition,
mm-hmm.
which is, I suppose, what we all must have no matter how smart we are and how much we've learned in science.
Right.
What do you see, Dean, as one of the best uses of intention? You know, we talk about intention so much. What do you, mm-hmm. what would you like to see in terms of creating a shift?
Well, at this stage, what we can do are pilot studies, essentially. We as your whole effort is in the intention experiment, we can begin to look at the power or the role of collective intention in a way that we've never been able to look at before because of the power of instant media and communications. So one example is intentional chocolate, which is seeing whether the intention, not a large amount of collective intention, but specialized intention by advanced meditators, could that affect food? And, of
mm-hmm.
course, this came about from thinking of the folklore of why mom's chicken soup is so good and the possibility that the love that goes into the cooking is an ingredient and that people can feel that or sense that in some way. So that this was a kind of a demonstration experiment that intention can do something which is pragmatically useful and measurable in affecting people's mood. But there are many,
yes.
many other areas where you could apply intention as well. You're doing some of them as part of your of the book. Others include things like if we could take a pharmaceutical drug like a statin to reduce cholesterol, and through intention, make it 1% more efficient in doing what it does. Well, not only would that be extremely useful, but that's a case where the pharmaceutical companies would not reject this kind of strange use of the mind, but in principle, they ought to embrace it because
mm-hmm.
it would take an existing drug and simply make it better without adding
mm-hmm.
anything other than intention. So one of the strategies that I've been thinking of is to take existing drugs, products, systems, you name it, and making them a little bit more efficient through the use of intention.
Yes, yes. Well, that I think that's a really interesting idea. I mean, we certainly put in an intention to stop so many side effects, too, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that idea of putting it into something, I had that experience when I was in Esalen for a weekend, and I couldn't believe how great the food was.
Mm.
And I had to ask them about it because I just had, it felt like I'd never tasted such good food in my life. And I found out afterward that they do a special intention thing with the food, and they have a wonderful, almost like an intentional kitchen, where they're bringing a lot of people who are volunteers in and letting them have a go at cooking. And I just thought that was really a wonderful idea of just using intention in practical life.
Mm-hmm.
I see intention on kind of two levels, which is the group intention, the mass intention idea. And as you say, I'm working on bringing practical and testing practical applications because being the kind of foot on the ground person that I am, I keep wanting to know, well, okay, what can we do with intention? Because we've seen what it can do in the laboratory, at least in these preliminary studies, but what, you know, what could you really do with it? Can you do anything, you know, really massive to alter the catalog of suffering in the world? And I think this is just the beginning of some of my little tests are some things we're looking at how to change polluted water. If you can change and mutate bacteria in polluted water, that would have an enormous implication,
mm-hmm.
or lower the temperature in a special ecosphere, or we're doing one on a violence study too, and those would again, have big implications if they work. But, of course, like anything in science, it has to be a baby step.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been thinking also about just intention using, we have a lot of people talking about intention in business and thing, and I think those are kind of interesting concepts, too, about the idea of starting to embrace just the use of intention, where business, which is so, business affects everything on the planet, is to start looking at making certain aspects of business intentional, so it's beyond just the profit motive, but people are actually stopping to create a real mission that goes beyond just making money and looking at the real ripple effect of what they do and sending some really specific intention. And maybe starting to try that in some other aspects, maybe education, just seeing if a teacher sets intention, if a doctor sets intention, what would happen?
Right.
Now, I know you are, at least Marilyn Schlitz is working on a study that is looking at intention and healing with breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's been completed.
No, we're still waiting to get the data. I think all the data has been collected, but we don't have it in hand yet. That was intention and wound healing.
Mm-hmm.
The tricky thing about studying intention is that it is always the case that the investigator is wrapped into the experiment. You can't extract them very well.
Yes.
And if intention, it does play a role, as I think it does in virtually every experiment, then the investigator's intentions become part of the mix. And if the if the purpose of the experiment is to study intention in the first place, you have a very, very complicated situation. So what I've started doing at the end of the papers when I write up an experiment on intention, I'm beginning to add a cautionary statement about how do you do a replication of this experiment. Now, in science, it's important that people be very skeptical about the results of the experiment, and yet if you're overly skeptical about an experiment involving intention, it will color your intention in the direction away from the hypothesis. In which case, to study intention, we need to develop either a new kind of epistemology, or we need to remind experimenters that they need to suspend their disbelief. They need to use proper skepticism, meaning doubt, as opposed to disbelief. And I've been amazed at how many of my more conventional colleagues find this extremely difficult to do. They just can't imagine doing an experiment where they have to suspend their disbelief.
Yes, I know. It is. I think it's just so threatening, the idea that the worldview could be slightly different. It's what we were talking about before. That just, I find some scientists find that very, very difficult. And we certainly, we find this. I know Rupert Sheldrake well, and I know that he's wonderful because he's really challenging a lot of these skeptics and saying, well, where's your science for this? And he's really saying, and we found this too with some of the things that we do. We've had people write in, and so-called columnists who claim to be scientists, debunking things like homeopathy. But when we've looked at their evidence isn't good.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think sometimes to challenge them and to try to demonstrate that what they're doing isn't really scientific, I suppose, is one of the important shifts forward, too.
Right. And also to highlight the epistemological assumptions in science. And this is, by the way, another reason why scientists resist this, because we're comfortable with hypothesis testing and the whole machinery. Of course, each discipline has slightly different machinery, but we're comfortable with those methods because that's what we were taught and that's what the journals will accept and so on.
Yeah.
But some of it is not completely right either. Just like some of our theories are not completely right, some of our experimental methods are probably not completely right. And so changing that is also is yet another challenge. So
I guess that is, it's just part of this unfolding. I'm sure that experimental methods, look at the history of medicine as we were talking about it. It wasn't so long ago that doctors didn't realize they had to wash their hands.
Mm.
So, we learn things and then it becomes a new way. And I think that the testing and the experimental method will be very different in 50 years' time.
Mm-hmm.
It'll have to take into account, as you say, things like, you know, how the experimenter feels about it, what the intention of the area is. And maybe this will inform things like medicine. I mean, wouldn't it be fantastic if a doctor walked in and had a little blessing for his waiting room and had a positive intention for it every day? You know, we won't know till the future what that will do, but just creating that kind of positive emotional exchange with the environment will probably make a big difference in the future in every regard if a teacher did that to a classroom.
Right.
What if we had one final idea about individuals and what they can do to make a great shift? What would you say that is?
Well, I think you're on the right track with the idea of setting a personal intention that is somehow in alignment with helping to spin the planet in a direction which is favorable to everyone. Just imagine the 6 billion plus people each waking up each morning and having a momentary thought like that. That would push very, very hard, I think, in a direction where we don't always see the effects of our own individual intentions on a large scale. Today, as we're speaking, is the day after so-called Super Tuesday, the big primary election in the United States. There's a good example of the results of tens of millions, if not more, people who each making an individual vote is changing the future. And it's the collective power of all those little votes that are adding up to change the future. So to answer your question, I would say that if we had a better sense of how to apply our intention, you know, what intention makes sense to apply? As long as there's conflict in intentions, even at a collective scale, I can imagine they all sort of cancel out. If you have half the people intending in one direction and half intending in the other, then it's a wash. So that helps bind together the collective mind and push in one direction is probably a way to go. Unfortunately, that raises the specter of something like a gigantic group mind, which is not always correct. In fact, oftentimes is not correct.
As we've seen in Germany and many, many other places, when a negative thought takes hold. But I guess that what is fantastic about now and what is going on, I think, for the shift going on in the world is that there are so many of these tiny pockets of resistance who collectively make up this giant force for change, all focusing on making some sort of change on the planet. And oftentimes these little pockets, as we've known historically, and people like Margaret Mead have written about, etc., is that they start forcing big change. And look at the change that has gone on. There isn't one company now bending over backward to demonstrate how ecologically minded it is.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps one of our big thoughts will be, once again, to try to, what I'd like to see shift is that companies start looking to something besides the profit margin and start looking at their ripple effect of what they do in the world. And if it's not good, don't do it. And maybe if it's not good for the planet, don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that would be one very simple intention for everybody could hold every day. And perhaps that would have extraordinary effects.
And that in order for that to happen, it would require a change in the law, at least in the United States. And in the United States, the commercial companies are compelled to create a profit. And of course, because it's built into the legal structure, it's difficult, I think, for the presidents and CEOs and for boards to not do everything they possibly can in order to uphold the law. So there's like one thing that could be changed so that it is not a legal necessity. Maybe it's desirable, but still it's not legal. necessity and to always create profit no matter what.
Yes, or to look at that profit in light of something that's an enhancer. I mean, I looked at some work that the head of Walmart had done, which I thought was pretty amazing, in that he realized that he's such an enormous force for change that if he started pushing organic food and ensuring that that his clothing was not created in sweat labs, that he could change the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he still is pretty profitable, but has made some changes there that are attempting to do some good in the world.
Hmm.
Now, I just looked at that and thought, now, that's just one thing that corporations can do, is just shifting their vision. You know, and as you said, to change the law, you know, we need a new stock market that rewards companies for doing good, not
mm-hmm.
just making money.
Right.
And maybe that will be one of the shifts in the future. But for now, perhaps it just takes a slight shift in vision to still say, hey, I can make a lot of money doing this too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I once talked to a guy from somebody, the head of somebody high up in McDonald's, and they said, well, of course we can't, you know, we can't have organic food. And I said, why not? And the question is, really, why not? They would change the face of the pricing structure for organic food if something as big as McDonald's bought it. Everybody would be able to afford organic food then.
Right. And I think people now are demonstrating that they're willing to pay more if they feel that it's something that's worth it.
Yeah.
So that will also help push it. So again, we're talking about the need of lots and lots of people who create pressure on a much smaller number of people who can make the decisions to actually change.
Yeah.
It's a combination of a mass necessity and the discernment among business leaders and leaders in the scientific and political worlds to respond.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, what do we need to do to make a great shift? Well, the Earth is compelling us to make shifts, whether we are consciously aware of it or not.
Yes, and I think what ends up happening, too, is perhaps one thing to end with is just individual, is that we need this mass organization happening, even if it's in little pockets. And that's, as you say, we're being pushed in that direction because of the state of the Earth now. It's telling us in no uncertain terms. But maybe one also has to recognize individually that it's possible, and that also change and intention are possible, and that they do change, and that setting some almost impossible intention is sometimes all it takes to change the world. And so on an individual level, allowing that this can be, allowing that you're much grander and greater than you could be, and that you've been told, and that you can use this potential for improvement in your life and improvement of the world is possible. Just allowing that intention, I think, and allowing that, acknowledging that, is also half the battle.
Very well said. Along the same lines, perhaps as a final thought, I think the reason why manned space travel is important is because it's a setting of intention for the entire planet or for humanity. Like if we could put people on Mars, it's not because we think we're going to start growing organic vegetables on Mars, but because it shows that what humanity can accomplish. It sets an intention for us into the stars. And yes, it'll cost a lot of money and it'll probably cost some lives and so on, but that's not the issue. The issue is one of an aspiration and an intention that is as large as humanity itself. That's why
absolutely. If we can do that, I think that's really a good point. That demonstrates the limits of human endeavor, in a sense, or at least a stretch of human endeavor. Maybe not even the limits of it. If we can do that, then you know what else can we do?
Right.
And to allow that possibility. And if we can do that, we can fix what's wrong with the planet now. If we can do that, we can fix what's wrong with our lives.
Right, right. So I say this because I've heard from a number of younger people, people in their 20s, who no longer, they weren't alive when we had the excitement of getting to the moon, and so they don't get the aspirational qualities of all of humanity sort of binding together to accomplish something which we thought was impossible.
Yeah.
And it inspired a whole generation. Well, I think we can continue to inspire new generations by making Star Trek real.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, what's interesting to me, Dean, is there's a good percentage of the people participating in the intention experiment are over 50.
Mm.
And that tells me something really interesting, being over 50 myself, that there's a huge body of people who were alive with the moon launches in the 60s who remember that positive feeling and those aspirational moments, and it hasn't died. They're still there. They're still hoping and intending, and they're now, I think, poised to do something about it, feeling that we are all waking up to the necessity of making change, and that a lot of the views that were held in the 60s now perhaps have even more necessary application.
Mm.
And so maybe this is going to be a revolution led by the old. Who knows?
A maturing of the 60s. Yes, I like that. Okay.
All right, Dean, it's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Same here.
We hope you enjoyed this offering from the Shift in Action Partners program and would like to sample more. Partners of the Institute of Noetic Sciences gain access to a weekly stream of inspiration, wisdom, media, and spirited exchange. The program includes live weekly teleseminars with visionaries who are lighting the way forward, Marilyn Schlitz, Dean Radin, Belvy Rooks, Larry Dossey, Candace Pert, Brian Swim, and many more. Our live teleseminars are then added to an extensive archive of audio and video on our website at www.shiftinaction.com, with new offerings each week from teachers like Marianne Williamson, Edgar Mitchell, and Louisa Tisch. The site offers the latest in community-building software that allows you to engage every piece of content as a focal point for education, exchange, and action. Join us in exploring the frontiers of consciousness.